Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Morteza Hajizadeh, your host from Critical Theory Channel, and today we are pleased to have Professor Tom McLeish with us. Professor Tom McLeish is a physicist, academic interdisciplinary leader, and a writer. He's the inaugural professor of natural philosophy in the School of Physics, Engineering, and Technology at the University of York in England. And today he's here to talk to us about the second edition of a great book he wrote called The Poetry and Music of Science, Comparing Creativity in Science and Art. Tom, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you, Morteza. I'm really happy to join you today.
Thank you. So to start, can you please briefly tell us how the book came about? And because you're a quite well-known writer in the area of science and humanities, but can you tell us about the idea of this book?
Yeah, sure. Well, of course, my core discipline is physics. I'm a scientist. I do write in the humanities as well, because I think that science belongs there. And I've always been so saddened by the way we have disrupted and fractured, fragmented our disciplinary world, as if the world itself knew about the difference between chemistry and English and history. The world is the world. So I love interdisciplinary stuff. But what catalyzed this particular book on comparative creativity in science and the arts came from a series of high school visits. I love talking, going to schools, and perhaps the 17, 18-year-olds, 16-plus, just to stretch them a little bit, you know, introduce them to what goes on. If they carry on this a bit further, you know, what do universities do? And then, so I'll perhaps talk about science and faith or science and arts or history of science. And then you get a picture, don't you, if you talk to pupils, young pupils, about which ones are really on it, you know, which ones are really bright. And some of those I'll ask, well, you're holding me against the wall, aren't you, about everything I'm saying. Why didn't you do science? Because in the UK, or in England particularly, you might know, it's possible to drop all your sciences and indeed all your humanities at age 16, if you wish. It's appallingly underproviding our young generation. Anyway, that's another question. But the really bright ones would never say, oh, because it's too hard for me. They would say, because there's no room for my own imagination in science, or there's no room for creativity in science. And of course, at this point, I froze inside, because I am a scientist. I've worked my nearly 40 years as a career in research physics. And I know that enormous amounts of imagination. Science is, you know, in brief, reimagining the world. So I realized I had to write about this and talk about it and have YouTube talks about it and everything. And work. I was at that point also chair of the education committee at the Royal Society, which is our National Academy for Sciences in the UK. And we were able to do something there. That's what was very exciting about serving in those sorts of ways, to actually try and help science teachers with their pupils at all levels introduce creativity into their science experience.
The story you said kind of sounded familiar to me as well, because when I was in high school, I'm originally from Iran, and in Iran, when you're in high school, second year, you need to choose a major. So it's science, math, humanities and then vocational. So I did science because there was a bit of pressure on me on the side of family as well. But in university, I switched to literature. And I remember the very first reason that I gave was, well, there's more creativity in humanities. In science, I have to follow rigid structure. And I was plagued by that idea until even 7 or 8 years ago. And I gradually began to change when I kind of broadened my horizons. And you, in the book, you talk about, I think one of the most important part of the book is the three modes of creative expression. We have the visual, the narrative, and the abstract. So I would be grateful if you could talk about these three modes. And it's a question also popped up in my mind when we were talking about creativity, which you can address after that, which is the nature of creativity in humanities and science the same, or still true that you exercise creativity in science? You still need to follow a process, a methodology?
It's a very good question, because the very reason that the structure of the book, this trifold structure, ended up as it is because of the blurred distinction between arts and sciences. You see, I thought I was going to write the book along the structure of some chapters on scientific creativity, some chapters on artistic creativity, and then some discussion. And you can't write that book. My methodology was twofold. I read extensively in the history of artists and scientists reflecting on their own creative process. Mathematicians too, Adamar famously, Beveridge for science, Henry James in the novel, and so on. But also interviewed people I know or with whom I could get introductions to, who are composers, artists, chemists, physicists, mathematicians, journalists, all sorts of people who create things. And I asked them to tell me the story. I said, well, don't give me the polished version of something you're particularly happy with having been brought to birth de novo from nothing, but tell me the story, the twists and turns, the ups and downs, what you originally set out to do, and maybe you couldn't do that, and all the story. Now, the scientists typically need a little glass or two to get them going on this, because we cover our tracks, you see. We're not supposed to talk about this. But when you hear the story, I realized I was getting a story, a narrative, a kind of narrative, which I've called the creation narrative of human creativity. By this, I don't mean all the different cultures' creation narratives of the cosmos, beautiful and wonderful though they are. I mean the innate human story of how we bring things to bear. We have a distant vision. We try some things. They fail. We spend a long period of time in the wilderness. We think about things. We interact with others. Sometimes, blessedly, an idea appears, a completely new route we hadn't seen before, and that turns out to be the way to finishing it. There's much rejoicing. Interestingly, it's an emotional story. I think we might be talking on that a little bit later. But what I couldn't do was divide this between arts, humanities, and sciences. What I did find, it helps me. Other people have characterized creativity in different ways. That there's this, some people create visually. They have visual ideas in their minds, or they even think visually on paper. Obviously, visual artists, for example, but many scientists, many mathematicians think visually. Not all. Some creativity happens through language, through words. So poetry is a sublime example of this, of course, and literature itself. But there turns out to be this deep, deep connection between literature and experimental science that I hadn't anticipated. And that's a wordy subject too. And then the third category is really apophatic. It's by what's left when it's not visual and it's not literary. When what is it? And there is this abstract mode of thought which one comes across in topics like mathematics, theology sometimes, music par excellence. And so I think that is the level at which mathematics and music link, not the trivial method level at which they're sometimes talked about linking, but very deep down in their abstract sort of transcendent nature. So yeah, so that was how the threefold structure arose. I forgot there was another thing you wanted me to... pick up on the
It was the idea of creativity in science and in humanities, because my assumption is that in science you still need to follow a set of scientific reason, let's say, or scientific method.
They do. But of course, the arts do as well. So I think most helpfully here is a phrase coined by Jacques Monod, which is day science and night science. Again, scientists, we don't admit to this very much, but we should do. Of course, there is the formal experimental method, checking hypotheses, carefully making measurements, carefully doing calculations or simulations. That's what we call day science. In fact, there's a podcast by a couple of friends of mine called Night Science, where they interview biologists predominantly, but other people from the world of science as well, to get to talk about their other side of the coin. You see, if you don't have imagination, you don't have a hypothesis to work on. There's this night science where all the creativity happens. Now, you might say, well, you know, but in art, of course, it's all the imaginative creativity. By no means. There's a highly technical methodological, whether you're composing music or putting oil paint down on canvas with a blade, or going over your manuscript, analyzing each word, rubbing out, finding new metaphors, getting it right. Artists, all creative artists, have methods which to me map very closely onto the more formal methodological aspects of science you've talked about. So although there are differences, obviously, that, you know, for example, science, we will come on to creativity constraint, but science is constrained by the real world. But artists have different types of constraints, but they do have constraints. So whenever I try to explore the differences, the thinking takes me more towards similarities and then a mapping between those similarities. So it's looking more increasingly close to me.
When I was reading your book, one thing I found fascinating was that how you had carefully mapped out or outlined the creative process a scientist goes through and found these comparisons that you mentioned. And I was reminded, and something that humanists are usually accused of is that what they produce is not really knowledge, because they don't follow a set of, they don't have a methodology, they don't have the scientific method to follow. And last year, I was reading this book called Humanist Reason, History, and Argument, and Plan by Eric Hale, whom you might know is a professor of comparative literature. And he had he did the same thing you've done in science, but he did it in humanities. That still in humanities, we also do follow process. We follow a methodology to come to that final polished product. So it's still knowledge, but it's a different kind of knowledge, like creativity that you have argued for. It exists in science, but the nature of it might be different, but the process, the artistic process, is still the same. This is the second edition of the book, and you have added a whole new chapter to this second edition, which is on poetry and science. And I guess this is your favorite chapter as well, because I know you are a big fan of music as well. So can you tell us about this new addition to this chapter?
Yes. Well, I mean, they could have had me up under, as it were, the Trade Descriptions Act, as we call it in the UK, with publishing a book whose title was The Poetry Music of Science, and not really discussing poetry very much in the first edition. So I knew I had to do something. But in particular, I had not realized, this is my own ignorance, I'm just learning, all authors, we learn as we go, as we write, of course. Wordsworth, in his the preface to the second edition of the Lyrical Ballads, I did mention this in the first edition, prophesied, almost it was like a prophecy, that one day science would be as appropriate a feedstock, if you like, or food for the poet, just as much as any other experience of humankind as enjoying and suffering beings, But of course, at that stage, science was still confined to a small, as it were, almost elite, as it basically is still today. So because of that, I thought, because more people neither enjoy nor suffer from science, and actually when engaged creativity, one suffers as well as enjoys. That's part of the story. Wordsworth had it absolutely right. It's not yet. It's not yet. And I felt it was not yet. But actually, I've discovered there is a wonderful, rich, continuous seam of poetic thinking through the ages. In fact, from ancient, of course, Lucretius's great poem, De Rerum Naturae, on the nature of things, is a poem. It's a Latin poem. And, you know, I've even discovered, well, yeah, not discovered, but discovered to the point of conjecture that poetry was quite a good candidate for the canonical form of scientific writing as experimental science took off in the 17th century. So, for example, at the beginning of the 17th century, the classic text on silk science and technology, it's a book called On Silkworms and Their Flies, is an extensive volume in Octavia Rima. Margaret Cavendish wrote her Atomic Theory in poetry. Of course, Milton has plenty to say about cosmology in Book 8 of Paradise Lost. So arguably, science might have adopted, if it weren't for the Royal Society and actually weren't for the plague historically that drove people out of London so they couldn't recite poetry to each other, they had to write letters, which became the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. So it was the letter form became standard rather than the poet form. I think it's a long shot, but it might have been otherwise. Of course, in the 19th century, you have an antithesis to this. You have people like Keats writing poems, accusing poetry as unweaving the rainbow. Poe, Edgar Allan Poe, accusing science as being that vulture. You know, eviscerates all the wonder from the world. Ugh. But I think they got it badly wrong, because science actually opens the doors, or can open the door to everybody, to new levels of wonder and glory and sublimity that we don't see with our ordinary eyes. And that's what science is. And in our own day, there are many own times examples of quite wonderful science poets. So Rebecca Elson, I spend some time studying in the new chapter, a cosmologist, astronomer. She worked with the Hubble Space Telescope. Sadly, she died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in the end of the 90s. Those who knew her still mourn her young loss. But she wrote beautiful poetry which engaged with her science. And because poesis, which we get the word poetry, but is also the ancient Greek word for really creativity, coming out of ourselves, is so much part of science, as we've already discussed. It turned out that just as soon as you open that door, a whole new world opens up. And like a parallel to the story I did have in the first edition of the novel, fictional prose writing and experimental science. So I think poetry goes along with theory because of its inventive nature and its core conception of creativity under constraint. You see, let me put it this way. Poetry, the creative step of poetry is to tension the imaginative outward thrust, explosive thrust bringing to light imaginatively the new within the soul, right? But if you just let imagination pour out of the table, you just have a mess. Like an English school teacher of mine once told me, I remember this lesson. It was the lesson on the sonnet. Said, why do we have such tight poetic forms like the sonnet? Well, it's because it would be a mess. He said, you only write a sonnet when you fall desperately in love. I won't tell you if I've ever written any sonnets or forms, but he said, but you need it because you've got the more explosive, or the more powerful the poetic imagination, the tighter the constraint you need of form. That's where form comes in. It's the opposition of imagination, form. Well, what could call upon the greater power of imagination than to reimagine the whole universe? And what could constitute the tightest form, then to make that imagination conform to the universe we actually observe. So the whole scientific project falls into this category of writing a giant poem. And that's why the chapter works.
It's a fascinating reflection.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Another fascinating part of the book that I'd never thought about was the rise of the novel in the 17th century. So you have this speculation, the rise of novel in the 17th century and the emergence of experimental methods in science. They happen to, they occur at the same time, more or less. So can you expand on that, please?
Yeah. Well, it was Pat Waugh, a professor of English, friend of mine at Durham University, where I was when I began the project, that came to me when she heard of the project. She said, "Tom, you know, don't you, that the coincidental rise of the early English novel and experimental method in science is not a coincidence, don't you?" And I said, "Pat, really? Wow, what? Tell me more." And she pointed to examples of the early English novel. Obviously, it's the end of the 17th century, beginning of the 18th century. That's the time we're talking about. Margaret Cavendish, we've already mentioned, in terms of the poetry, but she also wrote arguably the first science fiction novel, Blazing Worlds, in the mid-17th century, which is about another world which one reaches via the northern regions, it's up in the sky. And she wrote this novel as a framework for her critique of experimental method, and she was very critical of it. And in a sense, one should be, because the idea that one could learn anything about interconnected, universal, complex nature by doing something as disconnected, artificial, and simple as an experiment is very counterintuitive, except to us now. We're just used to it, and we think that people were silly by not inventing experimental method hundreds of years before they did. They weren't. But that's a little bit of an aside, although it does throw a theological hook, by the way, into this whole question, because it was Francis Bacon's theological analysis of grace that got over the activation barrier. So, you know, the part of this book, underneath the surface, is this really interesting and complex story of science and religion, which are tangled in much more interesting ways than the foolish and ahistorical conflict model we have today. There, didn't think we were going there, but you have to, really. You have to, because it's part of the story. So Daniel Defoe, not long after Robinson Crusoe, what does he do? He takes his whole world, is a little island, a single island. He puts one man on the island. He invents some goats, some particular species of goat. He gives the man a certain amount of rounds of ammunition left, and then there are footprints of another human being. And the rest. Now, the idea of the sheer chutzpah, as it were, you know, the hubris of being able to create our own small worlds, simple enough for us to grasp and to observe what happens in them, is, what am I describing? Am I describing the novel, or am I describing the experiment? And the answer is, I'm describing both. So that's really why the experimental method in science gets going. And then there are all sorts of ways in which they thread through history. Joseph Priestley, in a lecture to Warrington in the 1780s, remarked, "Isn't it true that that novels resemble scientific apparatus, like globes and orreries?" And he doesn't explain this. He said, and everyone nodded. And of course, the reason that everyone nods is because they are the ways into seeing through a small world that we humans can create in image, that represent and give us information on the big world. So actually, this is theology again. I just have to read you just a little bit of something that Samuel Taylor Coleridge wrote in his essay on the imagination, in his Biographica Literaria. He writes about imagination. He says, "The primary imagination I hold to be the living power and primary agent of all creation, as a repetition in the finite mind of the eternal act of creation in the infinite I am." So you see what he's doing? He's saying that both poetry and literature and experimental method is like a mini creation, a finite creation, created by who? Not by God. It's like an image of the creation. It's been created by the image of God. So he's calling on what's called Imago Dei theology that humans are made in the image of God, because the big I am is Moses. Of course, he's talking about Moses there and the burning bush and that story. So actually, there's a big triangle here over how literary, poetry, and science work together in a very human way, being creative, that somehow images the big creation. That's probably the best way I can put it.
Yeah, it all makes sense. And I never thought about, I'd read that section, I never thought about it in this sense. Let me ask you a final question. Like I said, you are a hardcore scientist. At the same time, you are an advocate of humanities. And your friend, I earlier talked to your friend a few months ago, Professor Jim Al-Khalili, who is more or less the same. He also recently wrote a book. Yeah, wrote a book, The Joy of Science.
Absolutely. He's also written about the fantastic Arab Islamic contributions to science.
And he made a series of documentaries. That's right. And you know that these days in UK, in Australia, where I live, there is a lot of, especially after COVID-19, humanities are being defunded and there is a lot of focus on STEM. And in Australia, the government has even a program where high school students are encouraged to do more STEM to boost economic productivity, of course. So how do you see the future of humanities? Or what do you think of this new trend in general?
I think it's desperately sad, appallingly short-sighted, and dehumanizingly destructive. I have almost no words, except those six. They weren't bad, were they, those words? But and I do what I can to inveigh against them. So in my role as a Royal Society I mentioned before, I made sure, and I'm not by, good news is I'm by no means alone, as a scientist in the UK, a relatively experienced one, in advocating for the humanities and advocating for the support of the British Academy right next door to us, for example, who's our National Academy of the Sciences, Social Sciences, and the humanities are so important. And this is the point. We began with this, didn't we? We began by reflecting on the fact that the world doesn't know about these disciplines. The world is the world. It's integrated. It has people and history and story, narrative. It has emotion. It has love in it. And all these things are real and true. And most of them are out with and beyond the remit of science. Science, the way I like to think of science, is as a humanity, as you might have picked up before. By the time you've blurred the distinctions between scientific creativity and that of art and literature and poetry and music, then you begin to realize, wait a minute, if we insist on STEM, we're going to be dangerously blindfolding our next generation. We're not equipping them at all. We're hobbling them. And, you know, the immense challenges that face us, not just the global climate change, but the growth of population, fresh water, the possibility of radical new discoveries in the cosmos that affect us as humanity as well as scientifically, superbugs. You know, it's a disgrace that, you know, that 60 years or 50 years on from the foundation of the United Nations, there's still so much poverty in the world. It's within our grasp to solve these problems. And it's the focus on particular disciplines and narrowness that has been the cause of the failure. It's all about being divergent thinking. We need to equip, even at all levels, we need to equip our young people to be richly endowed with what's called humanities thinking as well as science thinking, because it's all one thinking, really. And then even if you want to be instrumental about it, take one example, which is that of music. We know the scientific research has been done that offering music to every high school pupil, individual instrumental tuition, and the opportunity to sing, to listen to music, to think musically, not only is massively helpful for their mental health, but also assists and supports their logical, deductive thinking. Well, of course it does, because in the same measure that nature does not know about our disciplinary divisions, our minds, our brains don't know about them either. They're all one. It's all interconnected. The brain is about being interconnected. So this is what I would say, and not just say, I would plea our governments to drop this very short-sighted policy, ironically, not at all based on the scientific research that they claim to be supporting. Quite the opposite. It's just their gut prejudices, or, you know, what they imagine will be electable. It's just dreadful. And it's ignorant and it's dehumanizing. That's it. There's nothing good to be said about it at all. But of course, we need, as communities, to be forensic about this. And what we need, for example, we need scientists to stand up for this. Because although, of course, my humanities colleagues and professors and heads of the British Academy have huge weight, of course, when they stand up for the humanities, the answer from the politicians of the Treasury is, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? But when the president of the Royal Society gets up and says, we should fund the humanities, we should make sure that that school pupils continue to study humanities, including music, available to the age of 18, and we believe that will serve the sciences better. Oh, that's a surprise. We didn't expect you to say that. We expect you to fight your corner. That's why it's so important that scientists get involved in rebalancing the books here and having a vision of integrated knowledge.
I couldn't have said it better myself. And you mentioned there are hundreds of examples of very well-known scientists who were poets, novelists, critics, cultural critics as well. Yeah, and I hope more and more people like you, more and more politicians hear people like you and your colleagues as well. Professor Tom McLeish, thank you very much for your time and speaking with us about your book on New Books Network.
It's been a massive pleasure, Morteza. Thank you so much.